afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's Saturday afternoon, and I am Carolyn Yeager, your host, on a gorgeous October weekend. It is truly magnificent, yesterday too, and today, and here I am. I'm wondering if I'm going to have many listening to me live today with probably lovely fall weather in many, many places, even all around the world today. So, but here I am. At least I can look out the window and see that that blue sky and little breeze and sunny, you know, sunny and shadows moving along on the fence outside from the moving branches and so on. And it's very cheering. I don't have such a cheering topic for today. And I am going to try to approach this in the most fair and objective way that I can. I don't really even know. I've said before that I'm not going to talk about white nationalism anymore, that I was going to stick with revisionism and World War II and National Socialism and so on. Well, this all comes in together today. I'm not really talking about white nationalism, but I am in the sense that what's going on that I think impacts on all of us and on me too, and on whatever kind of beliefs you have or whatever kind of philosophies you think are best. What has been going on affects all of that, and what the attitude, in my opinion, the attitude toward National Socialism and Adolf Hitler affects what's going on with us and is very important. It's not something that we can set aside, and this is a topic I've gone into before. And I've said that, but for some reason things come up and then I feel like it needs to be said again. I wish that there were some people speaking about this in the way that I think it should be spoken about, but there aren't. And that's the way it is. I guess we all think that our particular perspective is the best one and needs to be heard. So that's what I'm doing today. And I want to start out, though, by thanking a couple of donors, in particular, dear Dimitar, and the other one, my gosh, I didn't write the names down. And and now it slipped my mind, although it shouldn't because it's someone I know. But I did get two donations. Donations have been quite slender lately. I even wrote to this person. I don't want to go and look because I don't have my email up, so I'm not going to bother with that. But maybe I should put my email up, come to think of it. I'm going to do that right now. Carolyn@CarolynYeager.net, because this program might have some people might be wanting to send an email question or comment. I don't know, everything's working very slowly on my computer since yesterday and today. I rebooted, but it's still taking a long time for these messages to come up. Wow, that's a little scary. I hope my sound will be all right. Let's see if I, it was Richard. Sorry, Richard. Yes, it was dear Richard from, I think he's from Chicago. Let's see. Yeah, Richard from Chicago. That's the one. Also sent a donation. So I really appreciate those two. I was going to say it's been a little bit slow. And I guess at this time of the year that happens. Speaking of, donors and listeners and readers and so on, I was looking at my server stats for September since once it became October, so it was complete. And I did discover that September, this September 2014, was my very best month ever. with 74,854 visits and 25,567 unique visitors. And also my radio show downloads have zoomed up this month. So I'm wondering if there's some odd reason for that and if it's not quite what it appears to be. But but it's starting out very strong for October also. So what my stats showed for September was 10,756 listens or hits anyway to that was the top one, the Heretics Hour program on fatherlands or white nationalism. That was, I don't have the date here, that was a little bit earlier in the month of September. And following that was the interview I did with Lana Lochteff at Red Eyes Radio on her 314 show at 9,292. And since I download and upload to my own site the show, that's the listens or the hits on my site only, not over there. I'm sure they must get a lot of them over there because I think being on that program in the beginning of September, I don't have a date on that either, but must have brought, I did get a number of emails from that from new people, and it must have brought some more attention and more people to my site, and that's why these numbers are so great. And the third highest show downloads are a table talk, number 27, and that was on the 11th of September. And I'll just give one more. The fourth was to include the Saturday afternoon. Had the fourth highest show with on September 3rd, which was the Bardesh and the Nuremberg trials, the truth about Nuremberg, it's called, something like that. And, of course, the ones that are earlier in September will have more downloads than the ones that are later. But it's all just for the month of September. So that was very good. So I'm bragging a little bit about that. I don't know if that will hold. But on I'll also say that for the month so far, October 1st and 2nd, I said it started out real well. I've already had 1,008 hits for the Matt Hale show that was done on Saturday afternoon. That was sometime in September. I don't have that date. But and then the second Hale show, Matt Hale show, which is kind of incorporated a lot about Matt Hale into the show on leadership, which was a Heretics Hour show. That one had as of yesterday, had 916 hits already. So that's doing quite well. They're doing quite well. I hope it keeps up. So one more thing I want to mention before I get started here is that I have now in my possession the original Platterhoff speech from the Institute for Contemporary History in Munich, where it was found, by others, and which I had to take down from my site a certain translation action was brought. So I didn't mind doing it. I thought, well, I didn't see anything wrong with using that one, but I have purchased it with the help of someone who, you know what you have to do to get that. You know, it's cost me a bit of money, but I don't mind that either. It's close to $200 that I've spent to have this, to have somebody in Munich go over to the Institute and sign in or whatever and request this speech from their archive there, and then to make copies of it there. They don't make copies of it themselves and mail them to you for a certain cost. They said that they were too busy. They didn't have enough staff to do that. So, but yet the speech itself doesn't cost anything, and it's paying somebody to do it for you. If I were living in Munich, I could go and do it myself. But and I couldn't find anyone there who I knew who would could that could ask. A German-speaking friend here was dealing with them and said, and they said that there was a woman who would do it for you know, for pay, who lived in Munich. So we contacted her and finally settled on her, and she had to go over there and request it. Like I said, they bring it out, and while she's there, you know, she has to use their copy machine or whatever and make copies and then hand it back to them. And that cost is just for the copies, I think. You just pay for the copies, however much they are. But she had to be paid for that, plus mailing costs and so on, and mailing it to me, registered mail and so on. But anyway, I do have it, and I've sent a set of the copies to Carlos Porter. I don't mind saying that already. He's going to translate it. I don't know that it probably hasn't even arrived to him yet, but it was sent, I think it was on Tuesday. And I'm going to send a couple more sets out to people I've already sent to the person that was helping me. And when I get that back, and it'll take a little while, but I will be dealing with that Flatterhouse speech again, and I will put it up on my site. And we will be comparing it and talking about it some more. So you can look forward to that. Now, I'm going to start out with a news story today about a French National Front senator who was elected to the upper house, who it has been determined, it actually wasn't a secret, but that he has a Jewish father. So, you know, we talk a lot about the success of the French National Front at, and you might say, I don't know if this is the reason, but under Marine Le Pen, she has refused to be anti-Jewish and anti-Semitic at all, and so that's not one of the rules about that party. It's an anti-immigration party, but it's no way do they want to be at all, racial. So racialist, it's pro-French, but of course this man is a Frenchman, and he's a 26-year-old son of a Jewish man. He's one of the first members of the of this party, the National Front Party, to be elected to France's Senate. He and another candidate, Stéphane Ravier, were elected on Sunday. And, well, you know, that's good. He's the youngest senator ever to be ever elected. But he was born to Sergei Rachlin, his son David. Did I give his name? His name is David Rachlin. He said his father was a socialist and a non-practicing Jew who died when he was 16. He's also commented that he's not circumcised and he was never bar mitzvahed. So he's downplaying the meaning of his Jewishness and says that they remind us that Jean-Marie Le Pen, Marine's father, was convicted for Holocaust denial and incitement to hatred against Jews. This story was in the Jewish Forward this morning, but his daughter has moved away from those positions of his and distanced herself from racist expressions of her father. And so what else we have to say about this is Rachlin, I already said that part. All right. So according to, you know, him saying that he doesn't feel like he's really Jewish according to the books. It was his father who was a Jew and so on. But how does this sit with people who believe that the Jew is a biological entity? And there are a lot of white nationalists who profess this and make a big point of it, that you people are biologically Jews, and it's not according to certain laws or rules of the different Jewish faiths as to who is a Jew. And so if you he would be a biological Jew in spite of the fact that he doesn't practice it. I'm not making a big opinion on this. I'm just bringing this up because this is going to be, you know, one of the questions that I'm going to, consider. And I'm going to consider today where these Jews fit in to internationalist parties. And he is into white nationalism, even if you call it white nationalism. Now, the party in France is not white nationalist at all. It's French nationalist. And so whoever is French is part of the, is okay in those eyes, according to Marine Le Pen anyway. He also said he was not, I already said that. Now, he said he was not religious. That's the way to be today. Don't be religious, you're safe. But if he had to choose one, it would be Catholicism because of its egalitarianism. And I thought, well, what's that? But he means by egalitarianism that he harbors sympathies for the equality and reconciliation movement of the anti-Israel activist Alain Sorrel. Alain Sorrel is he's known to quite a few people. He's very much at home or welcomed in the New Right type movements in France and Europe, and he's a friend of the black comedian Dieudonné. I'm not sure that's the right pronunciation for that. And also of Vincent Renoir, the revisionist, who all think highly of him. He's questioned the Holocaust, so he's called a Holocaust denier. But he comes from the communist left. I didn't know that. I was reading about him, and he was a communist. He was a member of the French Communist Party and all that. He comes from the left. And he has this equality and reconciliation movement is that it is to bring the, the cause of the workers from the left and the cause of social morals from the right and bring that together that's what he thinks is the right thing to do. And this Rockline said that what he likes about Sorrel is that he criticizes liberalism, and he says you can oppose Israel's policies without being anti-Semitic. So this Jewish question, who doesn't consider himself much of a Jew, is not going to be anti-Semitic. He doesn't like anti-Semitism, and that's where the rubber hits the road here. That's the big question. Can we do without anti-Semitism and have all these other supposedly right-wing society with a little bit of workers' paradise leftism and bring this together. There are a lot of people who consider themselves white nationalists in the United States who that's the way they look at it, although they would not accept Jews. They think they're anti-Semitic, but they want to bring together the left and the right in some form or fashion. And just offhand, what I can think of would be Tom Metzger and then his former follower or whatever, Wolf Wall Street, that Bob, and there's quite a number of others I could name, but this is something that holds with a lot of so-called white nationalists. So now there's different strains of white nationalism. Is one thing I want to bring out today. I've already done that with this. You see, some white nationalists think this is okay. Some think it's not okay. Some think other things are okay, and they emphasize different things. And it's not to put down or say anything bad about white nationalism. But I think, as I've said and hinted at for a long time, it's hard to determine what white nationalism is, because it takes so many forms and so many guises. And people are convinced that they all call themselves white nationalists. So I guess people who don't want to criticize it will say that you want strong white nations. That's what it is. And if you have different views about this, that, or the other thing, well, that don't make a big deal out of that, because at bottom, everybody is wanting the same thing. How many times I've heard that forever, that at the base, we all want the same thing. And, you know, I say, no, I don't think we do. I don't think we do want the same thing. We might want the same, we might want strong white nations, but what those nations are going to look like is very, very different, can be very different. So that's not the same thing in my book. Now, what I want to focus on today is simply what's called the New Right. And then there's also been the North American New Right and the Alternative Right versus the Old Right. Now, I'm the one who likes the old right. I'm quite, I don't see the need for a new right and an alternative right. And these rights, if I can put it that way, these forms of right society are modifications of the old right, and moderations, yes, a lightening up is what I would think of it as, of the old right. What Marine Le Pen did to the National Front from what her father was doing, lightening it up and trying to make it more popular and with the people, which there are certainly plenty of arguments for that. And then there are arguments against if it doesn't work, you see, if in the end it can't work out. And I'm on the side of thinking mostly that in the end it's not going to work out when you do that. It's not going to work out, even though it might look good for a while and you get votes and you're looking like you're very successful. You're not going to accomplish what needs to be done, and it's not going to work out at all. And you've thrown away a whole lot that's of value. And that's another thing that's going to be come up a lot today, is how people are throwing away and want to throw away so much that's of value for their new nothing that they're offering. Really nothing. Really, they don't have anything to offer, in my opinion. But already I'm making judgments there. So I'll go on to say that another problem, I shouldn't say the word problem. Another, something else that we see in white nationalism, which is not all, you know, down the line the same with everybody, came up on when James Bowery appeared on Lana Lochtoff's 314 show and said that, and I listened to that. I had seen that he was on there. I thought, well, that'll be interesting. And he said he knew a lot of white nationalists who were married to Asian women. That's true. I'm glad to hear that he said that, you know. He didn't exactly approve of it, but he didn't didn't want to find fault with it either. He sort of excused them by saying that, well, these were men who couldn't find a white woman, and so they took an Asian so they could have a family. Well, I don't know how convincing that sounds. They took an Asian so they could have a family, but they're white nationalists. What kind? You know, they're not going to have a white family. So I don't think that's the reason. And it's kind of blaming it on white women. They couldn't find a white woman. Why not? And I think that they could have found a white woman if they had really tried. I think these particular white nationalists, and he said he knew quite a number of them. He knew, you know, kind of a lot of them. And he's in IT, you know. He's in internet technology and so on. And so he knows a lot of Asians. I think that they didn't really try to find a white woman. That wasn't a high priority. They liked the Asian woman. And that was an easier deal for them, maybe a more pleasant or something, more less demanding. So they took an Asian woman. All right, but how can you call yourself a white nationalist when you make that choice? They're trying to blame, as I said, trying to blame it on the white women so that they're not to blame. They're guiltless because it's not their fault. They couldn't find one. And they wanted to have a family. That's what Bowery said. They wanted to have children. Well, they're not having white children in this way. But a lot of these white nationalists have convinced themselves that Asians are such a high-quality race, the North Asians, that it's perfectly okay. They're just as good as whites, and you can mix with Asians. A lot of them believe that. Now, there's another question as to that makes for a big difference in white nationalism and what it means. You know, some see it as that's not allowable, and others see it that it is. So that's a huge difference. I'm going to comment here a couple of things from, or one thing anyway, from Greg Johnson's at Countercurrents that he wrote about Richard Spencer. And I'm not going to read the whole thing because he was writing. He wrote a little something about how he wasn't going to the NPI event in Budapest, even though he was going to go. He was signed up for it, but he had canceled his transportation, and he recommended that everybody do so. Well, I need to talk for a minute about this NPI conference, which is all in the news today. And the latest that I saw about it was that there was some video of Spencer and the others in a pub that he had gotten into. He had entered Hungary, and a lot of others did too. And they didn't have a place to hold a conference. So they are some of them, or all of them, I don't know, but they were in a pub just visiting with one another, and it was nighttime, and the police came in, and a bunch of them, and raided the pub and checked them out, and they knew who Spencer was, and he says what they found fault with him about was that he didn't have his passport on him. And you have to carry your passport all the time when you're in Hungary, or, you know, if you're asked to show it, you have to be able to show it. And he didn't have it with him. So he couldn't show it, so that meant that they could arrest him. But they were just taking down everybody's names and information on them, and there wasn't, supposedly they didn't do anything, but they then they took Spencer and questioned him for a bit and then brought him back to the pub, and he said that they might arrest him later, but they didn't arrest him then, probably waiting for new instructions or something from whoever's in charge of all this. So there's been a lot of talk about this conference that Richard Spencer, who runs the National Policy Institute, was giving. And, of course, the main speakers were going to be Alexander Dugan, who I'm going to say a little bit about in a shortly, and Tom Sunich, and a German man, and some, I don't remember them all, and a member of the Jobbik Party, who after Viktor Orban declared that that this conference was canceled, could not take place, and that none of these people would be allowed entry into Hungary, and they shouldn't come. Well, then he announced he was not going to speak there anymore. So that's where this whole mess is. But Johnson wrote, Spencer kind of, what he wrote in a comment, I don't know why, but he said, "I have a lot of disagreements with the direction that Spencer has been taking NPI and Radix." He also has a web sign that comes out twice a year, a magazine online called Radix in recent months. And Johnson says he has basically abandoned ethno-nationalism and turned into an apologist for Dugan and reactionary Russian chauvinism, but I still wished to attend the conference and wanted it to be a success. And then this person named Arditi wrote, "It's no surprise that the Orban government has banned NPI event. Dugan's close ties to the Kremlin are a major factor. Richard Spencer, like Greg said, has sided with Moscow. When you add to that Jobbik's close ties to Moscow, this was a problem for Budapest and its relations with the Ukraine, I would say, probably, and maybe the EU. So this conference looked like a Russian provocation." And then he says, "Jobbik's links with Russian intelligence are so well known. They are in the MSM in USA," and he gives a link to a Newsweek article calling a Jobbik member who belongs to the European Parliament as being proven to be a Russian spy and being married to a woman who was a Russian spy, and she was probably his handler because she was married to two other men at the same time she was married to him, and all the things that he had done, and just implying, you know, that Russian intelligence is involved in a whole lot of this stuff and involved in Jobbik too. So, and he says, "Do you think Viktor Orban does not know this too?" So that was his reason for it. Then Greg writes another comment. He writes, "Spencer apparently was planning to deliver a speech on the virtues of deracinated, Americanism, in the vein of his recent remarks on Europe coming together and the emergence of a homogeneous European man," whatever that is, which was written about in Radix Journal on September 18th, according to this, "which I imagine would have come across as airheaded beauty pageant prattle in the center of Europe where national identities and ancient hatreds have very deep roots." You know, on this whole Ukraine business, I'm for the first time in a long time, more in agreement with Greg Johnson here. But it shows that that these people who are very good friends, Greg and Richard Spencer and this whole crowd, that are very very close intellectually, and they read each other's stuff, write comments and talk to each other and, you know, recommend each other and all that stuff, that they have these disagreements, and some of them are pretty deep. And this shows one, and it got even a little stronger later on, this disagreement between Richard Spencer and Greg Johnson, because Richard didn't much appreciate what Greg put on his blog about, or the Countercurrents site about how people should not go over to Hungary, because he wanted people still to come. But Greg said he was taking care of the people who were going to waste their time and money to do something that couldn't be done, and Richard was just looking out for his reputation for his conference and so on. So that's the way these things go. You can expect this kind of thing, but it seems like when it comes to the Moscow Ukraine thing, that that's a pretty deep division, and there's no consensus among white nationalists in that either. I will add here that that one more little thing here from, I don't know if this is important to do or not now at this point. No, I don't think I will. It was just a little statement from Arctos, which is another one of these groups in this particular whole crowd, that they said that they were withdrawing from their co-sponsorship. Well, I guess it is. Arctos was the co-sponsor of this European Congress in Budapest, and they wrote, I don't have the date here, but just very recently, that they regretted it, but they were withdrawing their co-sponsorship and participation in it, they would abide by the Hungarian government's decision that they didn't want that meeting taking place there. So the next thing I'm going to go to an article in the Budapest Beacon, which was entitled something to do with International White Supremacist Congress to be held in Budapest despite government ban. And this is BudapestBeacon.com. And it's got some interesting information, so I'm going to go ahead with it. The NPI says it chose Budapest as a venue because Jobbik is one of the most promising traditionalist political parties in Europe. However, both the far-right party's chairman, Gabor Vona, and its deputy caucus leader, Martin Gajon-Yozy, have already backed out of the event after learning of the participation of U.S. white supremacists. Then they talk about this is something else. Let me check here. Oh, this is information on him. All right, I guess that's all I've got. I was going to go to that, but I'm not going to that. All right. Now, one more thing to say, and I'm moving back over to, I'm with Richard Spencer, and there's been a lot of talk about Richard Spencer's Russian wife. And they get on Russian TV, it said, that they've been on Russian TV and speaking up for Moscow, and that Richard Spencer is very much expressed himself on the side of the Kremlin in this Ukrainian big problem and war, and that a large part of it is his wife. He's married to Nina Kuprianova, also known as Nina Byzantina, and she has translated Alexander Dugin's works into English. I have talked about her before on a previous show a little bit, just from this one source here, which says that she spends much of her time on Twitter defending Vladimir Putin and the Soviet Union, going so far as to claim Stalin was not a mass murderer. Interesting to note here that Stalin was a Georgian, not an ethnic Russian, and Byzantina practically brags about her Georgian ancestors. And then this source says Georgians are a mongrel Eurasian people. So, the question is, who is Richard Spencer married to, and why is he and his wife says that she's a Georgian, but she's called a Russian. And that's the thing about Russians, you see, is that Russians are a mixed race people. There are pure white Russians, but a whole lot. But you know, you have to be clear about the background of Russians, because there's all kinds of other stuff mixed in there, and more so all the time now. So, this goes with the idea of the Asian wives. And that's why I mentioned in the announcement Russian-wise, because Russians can be a lot of mixed-race stuff. And then, of course, there are some cases of having a Jewish wife, a Jewess as a wife. And that these people are all consider themselves very strong white nationalists. So, again, what... well, I'll just throw in here while I'm thinking about it. Well, it comes to mind that for some out of personal and reasons of convenience, because of their own situations, they see. I think that for a lot of white nationalists, the society that they envision is a society run by white people. Well, that would be good. That would be good, except what they mean is white men, really. It would be a society run by white men, and white men would be making the rules. And then if they could have non-whites in their society, no problem, although they would try to make sure that these non-whites were not in positions of power or were not making any of the rules. I mean, Kevin McDonald has said as much, that Jews are okay as long as you don't let them get into the highest positions. And my opinion on that is that you don't let them get into any positions. Even if they are going to be there, you don't let them hold any offices. But he was saying just the highest offices, so they could be in other positions. Well, you know, as soon as they get into other positions, they'll work their way up to the highest. I mean, none of this ever makes any sense. But it's said all the time. And this is the idea of so many white nationalists. And if the white nationalist men who run the white nation want to have all kinds of mixed white mixed people in it, that's fine. And if they and they're certainly going to have other women in it, not just white women, so that they can and you know engage with these other women, that's fine too. So how are they then going to continue on with the white nation if people are getting all mixed like that? This is the problem with white nationalists. They've almost all, not all, but a very much higher number than should be, or percentage than should be, have got a lot of questionable non-white stuff in their lives. And they're not really that strong about white. What they really want is for the guys like them to be in charge. That's what they really want. I don't know how much they care. They want a nation, yeah, run by whites for whites. But there's all these things I just mentioned. How do you fit that in? I'll leave that there. And say a little bit about Richard Spencer, which I think is interesting and says something, which is why I'm going to include it here. He was born in Boston, Massachusetts. He grew up in Dallas, Texas. He graduated from a number of schools and was a doctoral student finally in history at Duke University. He was assistant editor at the American Conservative and then editor of Talkies magazine, and then he founded Alternative Right in 2010, a webzine that he edited until 2012. Now Alternative Right has been taken over by Andy Nowicki and Colin Liddell, who I'm going to talk about later on, and he created this NPI, National Policy Institute, and then Radix, He's been published in all the usual places. He founded Radix in 2012. It says that for his Radix Journal, the contributors it have included Kevin McDonald, Alex Kurtagic, Sam Francis, Andy Nowicki, and Derek Turner. And he also hosts a weekly podcast at Vanguard Radio. Now, here's something further on about Richard Spencer. Greg Johnson, who you already talked about, when he was editor at Occidental Quarterly, stressed how Spencer's concept of the alt-right was about bringing together a wide variety of perspectives that are outside the purview of the American conservative movement. So these people are basically conservatives, have come from the conservative movement but want to go further, but they can't go all the way to the right. They don't like it, I would say. So they create these other kind of right things like new right, in this case alt-right. And, you know, with the new right, there's also the European new right, the British new right, and all of these have been put before us as being really the cream of the crop, the great intellectuals of our time, and the best things going. And I of course, you know, said, oh, that's great in the beginning, but I soon started to feel differently about them. You also find a lot of homosexuals in all these groups. I'm not going into that today. Not everybody thinks that's a problem. But there again, you have the problem of the white birth rate, and that doesn't help that at all. So so I will just go on with what Greg Johnson said here. He said that this new alternative right will attract, created by Spencer, will attract the brightest young conservatives and libertarians and expose them to far broader intellectual horizons, including attracting conservatives and libertarians. Well, that's okay. You got to attract new people, and including race realism, which they don't know anything about, white nationalism, the European New Right, the conservative revolution, traditionalism, neo-paganism, agrarianism, third positionism, anti-feminism, and right-wing anti-capitalists, ecologists, bioregionalists, and small is beautiful types. This all came from Greg Johnson back when he was just, you know, hunky-dory with Spencer, and they've been okay, I think, all along until this little thing with the conference in Budapest came up, and probably the Moscow, Ukraine situation, because they're on different sides of that issue. So I say, though, about what Greg had said here, with all this, you know, all these different kinds of horizons to look at, all these names he gave for different kinds of isms, how can there be any identity? You know, because they're saying, well, you can be this, you can be that. We've got, you know, all kinds of isms here. If this is your cup of tea, well, we'll give you, you know, something to, we'll include this in our horizons. That's what he's saying. We'll expose you to all these things. Well, it seems fake to me. It's not that it's meant to be fake, but, you know, how it seems like a way to destroy or prevent a movement when you include all these things as having value, including traditionalism, neo-paganism, agrarianism, third positionism, anti-feminism, anti-capitalism, bioregionalists, you know, on and on. The last thing I want to say here is that Spencer advocates a non-interventionist foreign policy and has criticized both neoconservative and humanitarian interventionism. That's probably something he wrote himself and put in there, you know, or some friend of his did. So he, Yeah, it's the usual right-wing stuff. And in July 9, 2012, he was interviewed by the Russian-based television network RT about the situation in Libya and harshly criticized U.S. policies. Well, he's a big critic of U.S. policies, and he's very, very sympathetic to Russia and probably Eurasianism, and that's why he had Alexander Dugin as the featured highlighter of the conference. And what we don't hear about very often is that his wife has translated books by Dugin, and of course she speaks Russian, and she is Russian, although she's, according to this source I had, according to her, she's proud of her Georgian ancestors. I don't know how many of them there are. But I pictures of her, she's very, well, she has white skin. She's very, very dark hair, these very dark eyebrows, and very busty, and, well, she looks exotic, I will say that. She looks quite exotic. All right, I've got a little something here from Peter Kreko of Political Capital. Peter Kreko is a Hungarian, and he says that many of the possible participants in this, this is current, and he's written about it in about the conference that was closed down. And he says that many of the possible participants are fringe figures or has-beens. The former Kremlin darling star is now in the descendant, meaning Alexander Dugin. He said this to the Budapest Beacon. I guess this is from the Beacon that I mentioned earlier. It is. This Kreko says Dugin was a professor at Moscow State University, but according to himself, he was recently fired for an extreme statement about Ukraine. And this statement has gotten around that he had actually said in some public forum that the best way to deal with Ukrainians is to kill, kill, kill. There should be no more conversations. As a professor, I think so. That's what he said. Well, that got him fired from Moscow State University. And it's thought, of course, that came directly from the Kremlin, that he went too far and that he's definitely out of favor with Putin. And that wasn't the only reason. I mean, it started earlier, but that may be what started it. I don't know. But this reminds one of Ilya Ehrenberg, another Russian, a Russian Jew, who was the one who said to towards the end of the as the Red Army was closing in on Germany, kill you gallant soldiers, kill the German and rape his women. And he said a lot more about raping the women and so on. This is something that Dugin seems to think is something he can say too. Kreko said, quote, there are some ideologues around Putin. They can form public opinion, and Alexander Dugin is one of the most popular public figures in Russia, but they are disposable. Putin can pick them up and throw them away. For Putin, ideologies are merely a tool in the power game, and he can change his ideology in a short time. Surprisingly enough, Jobbik was the biggest name that was scheduled to attend this European Congress, the Spencers, and the only player with real political support. Dugin is not as influential as he was. Dugin has also enthusiastically endorsed the Russian government's action in Ukraine, calling on Putin to go further and invade East and South Ukraine, which he says welcomes. He said that Ukraine, he told Putin that Ukraine would welcome Russia, waits for it, pleads for Russia to come. This was advice he gave to Putin, which would have been earlier than the kill, 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 I think, and Putin was listening to him for a while, but the advice turned out to be wrong because the Ukrainians were not hoping for Russia to invade and take over. Only in Crimea that appeared to be the case. So That's it for Dugan. This whole shebang here is pretty much done for. Now, I'm going to say a little more about Dugan here. And this is from a New Yorker magazine. I know. But it's from back on August 11th. But I think it still has some interesting information. It says that Igor Strelkov, remember Igor Strelkov? He was the head of the pro-Russian rebels in eastern Ukraine. And then they started doing poorly because the Ukrainian army finally got itself together, and they were making a big push, and they were took back a whole lot of territory, and they were in essence winning. And at that time, Strelkov was called to Moscow along with another one of the leaders, and he never came back. Somebody came up in his place, and so on. But it was at that time that the Russians started sending in big-time war material and so on, and began to help and even come into the country. Russian troops even come into Ukraine and help push back the Ukrainian army. So it says here by this New Yorker researcher that, and there's been some pretty good stuff by these people in the past when it came to Iraq and Iran and so on. He was leading the separatists in Donetsk, and this Prokhanov is how I pronounce it, who is a media king in Russia, very favorable to Putin. He posted a veritable ode to Strelkov on the Zavtra website, saying that the Russian fight in eastern Ukraine was a battle for divine justice, and comparing Strelkov as calling him a Russian warrior knight, a perfect hero, comparing him to the most fabled generals in national history. So in Russia, they play this up in a way that we have no idea. We don't really get it the way that the Russian people are getting this propaganda. But to Prokhanov, this glorification of an armed agent, which is Strelkov, is only natural. For war, the war for Ukraine was a matter of highest principle. And he's not an outlier on the ideological scene in Russia. He's he's not a geopolitical theorist either, like Alexander Dugin, who's called a mystic and high-minded crackpot. But Dugin has been published in Prokhanov's newspapers. And Dugin has said that his father had probably worked for military intelligence. Just a word here that that intelligence in Russia is probably what they spend the most on, do the most on. Maybe they don't have to spend the most on it, but it gets hugely high priority. Russia, even before it was communist, had a very advanced intelligence network and secret service and everything all around the world. The Russians have always been like that, and the Soviets had an exceptional intelligence network. In fact, even domestically, everybody was spying on everybody else. They hire and they train, I don't know if it's thousands, if not almost a million, you know, hundreds of thousands, maybe higher number than that, of spies and agents and so on. Every kind of agent to go everywhere, all over. They've got agents everywhere. And that's how they do as well as they do. That's how they won World War II, really. Because they knew what everybody was doing. They really did. Stalin knew what everybody was doing, and they didn't know all that about him. And Germany probably had the worst, because British are also very good in intelligence, and the Americans are not shabby. So I would say the Germans probably came in last, and that was an important weakness on their part, and a lot of their intelligence were corrupted, the German intelligence. So, in the Soviet Union, you were frightened for your life, so you couldn't be playing too many games there. But people were being reported all the time. People were just reporting other people. And it's a horrible way to live. It was really terrible there. And I think they've still got that same kind of thing going on. In Russia, certainly under Putin, he would depend on it quite a bit. So you've got to, it's a lot of people would be working in military intelligence. And it says that the day before this person writing met Dugin, it said the day before I called on him at his office, he had been mysteriously dismissed from his teaching post, where we already talked about that. And he said that he conceived of Putin as a man divided within himself, the solar Putin, which was the patriot and fierce conservative, and the lunar Putin, who was the conformist and pro-Western. Well, you know, Dugin is a mystic, so he's always got to come up with things like this. And this writer says that he's a sun worshiper. He would like the solar Putin and not the lunar Putin. And the only the invasion and annexation of Ukraine totally will satisfy Dugin. Now, let's see here. Well, I'm going to skip by this, what I've got. Boy, it's 3 o'clock already. I'm going to skip what I've got here on independent media in Russia and what a hard time it's having. It's pretty interesting. But it comes from the BBC, but they did a good, some journalists did a good study and interviewed a bunch of people on this, and that they're moving out. Anyway, freedom of the press is, freedom of expression as a, in journalism is having a very hard time. And, okay, where is this? One man said that what comes across the television is just hostile. It's radioactive. He calls the Russian television radioactive and says that what's being given to the Russian people about this Ukraine situation. It's just, he says, it's just shocking and horrible, the lies that they tell. And one thing, he said in August, Gazprom Media's NTV, Gazprom has a television station, aired 2 films branding a number of leading cultural figures as friends of the junta. I don't know if these were maybe Russian cultural figures, but they were called friends of the junta. He said that Russian state TV's terms for the government in Kiev, is the junta. That's what they call it there. It took over from something legitimate. Well, of course, they thought that the ruler that was there and friendly to Russia was legitimate. So that's kind of understandable. I'm going to move on to a little story here about Latvia, very short. After regaining, Latvia has a large, I just took this part out of it, that Latvia has a large Russian minority. And after regaining independence in 1991, following 5 decades of Soviet occupation, Latvia and Baltic neighbors Lithuania and Estonia turned west and joined NATO and the European Union in 2004. Well, they did that on their own accord because, you know, it just says here, after 5 decades of Soviet rule in their country, they wanted to get away from that. They wanted to get away from Russia, even if the Soviets had disintegrated supposedly, and the country was now just Russia. They wanted to get away from Russia. But, you know, Russia put a lot of, the Soviet Union put a lot of Russian people into these three Baltic countries and in other countries, too, and also into Western Ukraine, Eastern Ukraine. And I think, of course, the way they divided up, that was different. Okay, and also into Poland. So, but not like these others. So there's a lot of Russian speakers who still, it wasn't all that long ago, who still identify with Russia, who live in these countries. And it makes it a problem for them. So it says, about one third of Latvia's people speak Russian. You know, Latvia only has 2 million people. 2 million in the whole country, a country of 2 million people. Wow. But still, one third of them speak Russian as their native language. And many of them aren't even Latvian citizens because they cannot or don't want to meet Latvian citizenship requirements, including speaking Latvian. To become a Latvian citizen, you have to speak the language. They won't learn the language. They want to continue to speak Russian only. And this one man said, a 62-year-old man from Riga, said, I was born and raised in Latvia. I don't understand why I have to take a citizenship test if I was born here. And so 2 years ago, he decided to apply for Russian citizenship instead. Well, to have his citizenship, he had to speak Latvian, but he didn't want to. So now he's a Russian citizen, but living there in Latvia. And so, speaking about Russians coming, leaving Russia, and also Russian Jews moving all around other places. On Paul Hickman had a very good program this last past week. This earlier this week, with a German named Herr Wolf, a National Socialist. I listened to it, and I'm going to post it on my website because I think it's so good, and I'm going to do that after I get this show posted. Anyway, this one thing that was said there was that. This man said that regarding the anti-German communist Antifa, he said that they are very dangerous now, and a lot of young Jews coming from Russia to Germany in the last years. So a lot of the Jews that are still coming around into Europe are from Russia. Russia has so many Jews. Thinking about revisionism, a lot of Jews who went deep into Russia and even were sent to work camps and so on, and amongst the ones who did survive, they're still there. And we don't know the numbers because they lied about all of that. So these are Jews who are supposed to have been killed in the Holocaust. Well, now there just seems to be an endless stream of Jews that can come from Russia and go to other places, and they're not going to Germany, according to this German. So the point of all that was that we have white nationalists that are defending and promoting different, very different worldviews and very different racial views and very different friends that would be friends of whites and so on. So there again you have such deep divisions among people who call themselves white nationalists that I find it confusing, and I don't think it makes for the term not meaning very much unless you question and find out exactly what kind of white nationalism these people are thinking about. And I think, as I said before, a lot of it is traditionalism. Basically, what they like to call traditionalism, especially these new right and alt-right, and it's what I described earlier, that it's ruled by white men, and they don't even mind having homosexual white men among them. What they don't want is to have any kind of feminist or, you know, feminine of any great number participating. So it's not a healthy nationalist, well, they're not even a society, but if you have a healthy nationalist society, it's made up of men, women, and children, families, and so on. It's not made up of a bunch of ideological, ideologically thinking men in some kind of traditional idea of the way it used to be back in the Roman days or something. It's for the nation, and they miss the boat on that because they don't have. Most of these, they're Americans, and they don't have a nation to identify with. They're mixed. So I've talked about that before, so I won't go on. I'm going to go on to my main theme, which is, I'm not, I just went right through that stuff. That's okay. I'm doing what I said I would do. So I'm going to go on to Colin Little's attack on the Daily Stormer and how much he dislikes Nazis and doesn't think there's any future there. And I'm doing that because what I really want to get at here is this white nationalists who are very much opposed to national socialism. And there's a lot of them. I don't know any of these names that I've mentioned so far that were all kind of friends together. That ones that Greg Johnson gave as being, no, as somebody gave as being, Greg Johnson gave as being, or maybe it was Wikipedia gave as being contributors to Richard Spencer's site, Alt-Right, or something like that. But, you know, the names that I've given, that I've mentioned, I'm not going to repeat them, because I don't want to, say, these people. But they're all anti-National Socialists and think it's a big, big mistake to ever even talk about it. We don't want to be associated with any of that. So, Colin Little wrote a piece this past week about Daily Stormer and Andrew Anglin, and it was very uncomplimentary, and Andrew Anglin answered it on his Daily Stormer site. And Colin Little then wrote a follow-up, but that was the end of it. And there was a lot of comments which also pointed out the way these people are believing and thinking. And this, I'm going through here the Colin Little's second response after Anglin kind of responded. And he titled it A Brief History of Political Marginalization. Now this Colin Little, he says that, well, he's English. He's English, see, and so are a number of these people who are so anti-National Socialists, so anti-Hitler. It's a funny thing, because among the non-German supporters of the Third Reich, some of the best and strongest are British and always have been. And I can name some, like the National Front, what's his name? I have to see it. I can't think of it. That Paul Hickman did a bunch of shows on reading his book, and Paul Hickman and Richard Edmonds and a lot of people. Now I've got a lot of people say that I bet this is somebody giving me a name that I yep giving me the name John Tyndall. Thanks very much. is who I'm speaking about. There's a lot more I can't name right now, but yet at the same time, there's a thing amongst English and British to be extremely anti-Hitler, and even to the point of practically being anti-German when you get down to it, but they try not to do that. Based on, I don't know what, maybe based on their own feelings about it, genuinely, or maybe that the British patriotism growing up in Britain with the feelings that are all over the media. We know how strong the British media takes out after all Hitler and everything to do with any of that, so powerfully that maybe they're influenced by that, and they really do believe that even if it might have some value, it has no future. You know, it's just the dead horse. You can't bring it back because you'll never convince, say, the British people to accept any of it. Well, I don't see it that way. I think it's how you go about it. I don't think people who are able to go about it in the right way get any help from our white nationalist movement, from the movement, larger movement, because so many of them don't want this, and therefore they tear it down as much as the mainstream does. So I'll start out here with I'm just going to pick out of this. I've already shortened it, but I'm just picking out of it certain things that Little said that stand out to me as being, you know, extremely anti Third Reich. And the first one I'm going to say is he writes, essentially, because his message, he's talking about Andrew Anglin's message, essentially because his message only works with hardcore emotional white nationalists, and only those white nationalists who want to isolate themselves from the rest of society. It is essentially preaching to the choir and telling everybody else to go to hell. He's saying that if you would talk about this isn't the best one, but if you would talk about National Socialism or Hitler, you're isolating yourself from the rest of society, and you're not including other people because they're not going to be able to hear this message. So you're just talking to a little group. Well, there might be some truth in that. Okay, then he says, this is a mirror image of how nationalists who allow themselves to be associated with the Third Reich appear to members of the public, in other words, as complete nutcases living in a particularly dark and sticky corner of the past. You see how he talks about it. I just find that rather offensive, you know, to say that if you even associate yourself with the Third Reich, you are seen as a complete nutcase in living in a dark and sticky corner of the past. Meaning, you know, we can't go back to the past. We don't want to go there. That's over and done with. There's nothing worthwhile there. I find that bothers me a lot. Naturally, it would bother me, but. I think that's overboard, but I'm just continuing here. He says socialists enjoy their enormous success because they skip lightly over Pol Pot, Stalin, Mao, and Kim Il-sung, the Korean, and connect their ideas with what they redefine as the basic interests of the people, even though their vision is ultimately a poisonous and destructive one. So he's saying that The left wing, don't talk about the evil men in their past. They don't talk about Pol Pot, Stalin, Mao, but our stupid people want to talk about Hitler. Well, you know, he's putting Hitler on a par with these guys, and he's content to leave him there and saying, let's move on. Let's leave Hitler back with the evil past, the dark and evil past, where he belongs. See, and there I have a total disagreement with that. I guess I could throw in here right now, which maybe I haven't said yet or made clear that, but if you just know me, you know that I think that, that how to put this, what the National Socialists did in the 1930s was the best that we've ever had. And we've never had anything that good. And that's why we shouldn't leave it back there, and we shouldn't attack it just because of what happened during the war and the way it's been presented to the world by our enemies. We're letting the enemies have the final say here in determining what we're going to be able to do, which is mainly, according to these guys, kind of a mixed society that they hope to be in charge of, which they're never going to be. I mean, what they would like to do, and the power and the tactics that they use, they're never going to have it. Forget it, you know. And talking about these parties, I guess this will come up yet. I think it hasn't come up yet, so I won't add that here. But this is my position. So, see, I can't agree with this. That this would be the way to go, and we would do better if we did this. Because I think we would do better if we would take what we got from that time and make use of it. And there's tons of it. There's tons of material and all kinds of literature and intellectual arguments and so on. And the whole thing was worked out for white people. And yet, because of the war and which was brought about by the British and the Americans, and of course the Soviet Union had been hoping for war in Europe all along. That's what they were waiting for, you know, to take advantage of that. So, but anyway, this will come up again. It says. Little says, white nationalists of the Daily Stormer type, and my attack is not, now this is what's important, he says, my attack is not just aimed at Andrew Anglin and all those who strive to harness white nationalism to Hitler's, He says, it's not just aimed at Andrew Anglin. And, you know, Andrew Anglin has acted like it was all against him. He's attacking me. He's attacking what I'm doing, you know. Well, he did, but I think it's true that what he's really attacking, what he really doesn't like, is Hitler, you know, and anybody, not just Anglin, but anybody who wants to combine white nationalism with National Socialism, which what he calls Hitler's corpse, which is a nice, ugly way to put it, you know, and denigrating way to put it, which is what he's doing and what they all do with Hitler. And all those Third Reich characters, they love to denigrate them in every way possible. And then he says that even though nationalism is the essence of the basic interests of the people, it looks like a clear defeatist strategy to connect it with the worst excesses of the past. Okay, nationalism itself is good, and the people can understand that. But if you connect it with the worst excesses of the past, it looks like a clear defeatist strategy. Well, he is connecting National Socialism with the worst excesses of the past. He's doing that. He's accepting that 100%. The whole narrative of the whole Jewish narrative. Now, how are you going to win out if you accept the Jewish narrative and demonize your own people and your best people because of what the Jews were able to accomplish, and then think you're going to go ahead and do something successful based on that. He says, what actually happened in Nazi Europe is, of course, a question of great historical interest, but whatever the actual details, one thing is sure, not much of it was pretty. All right, so I left out a few words there, but you know the point is that he's accepting that what happened in Nazi Europe was not pretty, And whose fault was it? Well, he's not saying that the Jews weren't wrong, but he says the images to codify this in this ugliness of what happened in Nazi Europe, to codify it in images of evil Jews getting their comeuppance appeals to certain white nationalists. What he means, ones like Andrew and others who follow along that, others who like National Socialists. He doesn't want evil Jews to get their comeuppance. Well, I'll tell you, I'm one of those white nationalists then who that appeals to, because I've said for a long time, I don't want Jews to get away with what they've done. And I do not want to just say, oh, well, this was all a mistake. Let's forget about it. I'm not even satisfied with that. I want Jews to pay for what they've done. So, but he doesn't. He doesn't want Jews to pay for what they've done. He goes on, another strange thing he says is more of the same. In the UK, in the 1960s and 1970s, before, he said the boot boy look, even with Nazi trimmings, had something of a coolness quotient. So, here to me, he's just saying, well, if it's just kind of a fashion thing, well, that's all right. We can have a little bit of Nazism, in the dress and so on, but not anything serious. He talks about that a little bit. Then he says the whole boot boy Nazi aesthetic was just another way of being authentically working class and rebellious. So, again, it's just a kind of a dress thing to kind of be to show that you're a rebel, but not anything to be taken seriously as a principled and intelligent ideology that's well thought out and has a clear direction to go in. He says that was a time, after that things changed and political white nationalism rose up for a while in the guise of the National Front and brought with it some of this imagery and attitude. He says the decision was made to demonize the whole package. Well, what he's saying is when white nationalism, as the National Front, rose up and brought some of this Nazi, what he calls Nazi imagery and attitude into the forefront, in their party. Then he says, at that time, the decision was made to demonize the whole package, by which he means not just the Nazism, but the white nationalism and the nationalism. And this was not hard to do, as the Nazis had left plenty of material to work with, and what they hadn't could easily be fabricated or imported from communist Europe. So he's admitting that they didn't have all that they've done was not based on things that any Nazis had really done, but it was fabricated and imported from communist countries, from where communism was in control. So, but you see, again, he gives way. He's cowardly. He's really cowardly. He's looking for an easy way by what's called conceding in every kind of direction with what we don't want. But he concedes with it because they demonized this National Socialism to such an extent that there's nothing that can be used of it. And he said, interestingly, he says, Auschwitz, after all, started its life in the public consciousness rather in the same way that Katyn did as part of Soviet propaganda. So he admits here that it's all propaganda, but yet he says that it's actually, it's in the minds of people, and you can't get it out of the minds of people. So, to me, he's admitting that he doesn't care about the truth, And he doesn't care about Germans either. He doesn't care what happens to Germans in Germany. He's British, and he thinks Germans today don't care about it either, but that's really not the case. He's British, and he concerns himself with what the British can tolerate in order to save British white people. That's okay, but that needs to be remembered. When people call themselves white nationalists, they say they speak for all white people. This is the same that happens at majority rights, and it's an Anglo-American directed comes from that perspective also in general at majority rights, and they have the same position. They take the same position as this Colin Little did, at least a guest worker, and now the fellow who's doing it, and I have something from him too coming up. Another thing Colin Little said was he calls it the poison of Nazi associationism. You see how the words that he uses. I mean, he's not going to say one word that's favorable, not one word ever in any way. He can't for some reason, and he just thinks it's all. He paints a picture of how the National Front ladled out to their unsuspecting members some kind of bad brew, poisonous brew, and even some of them drank it down. And they all drank it down, and some of them even shouted, "Sieg Heil," and he just finds that disgusting. Well, there's too much of that, but anyway, I agree there's too much of that, but I would go about it differently than what a lot of these groups do. I would, and if I have time, I'll talk about that. But I don't have the attitude toward what was in the past the way that he does. Like, it was such a horrendous thing. Because he says here, I need to move on. Whoops. He says, the track record of Nazi associationism in killing nationalist movements is clear. Especially in the Anglophone world, it's pretty solid that if you have any Nazi associations, it's going to kill your nationalist movement. And he says that that's what happened to the National Front, in his opinion. that's why while it was looking like it was doing well, that's why it fell down, why it went backwards. I don't know, but he's saying that these parties today don't do that, and that's why they're doing well. They have set all that kind of thing aside, and he says he's talking about the victories of the Front National in France, the Sweden Democrats. Where are the rest of these? That's somewhere else, I guess, where he lists more of them. He says that just recently, these two parties have had victories, and they're the result of political realism and avoiding, like the plague, that kind of imagery, that kind of National Socialist imagery and rhetoric. And not just National Socialist, but I should have been saying all along, which I haven't, is that it's anti-Semitic. It avoids anti-Semitism. And that's what he's really accusing Anglin of, mostly, is the anti-Semitism in, the in-your-face type. And saying that that doesn't work, and that these parties avoid it. They don't want to talk. They don't talk about it. And this goes back to the very first thing I said today, and that there's this Jewish man who's representing Front National in the Senate. He's a member of the party, and he is half Jewish, and there's no problem with that. So. Liddell says, I'm going to skip this part because I'm really not interested in the argument between him and Andrew Anglin over, what the use of the Daily Stormer is and so on. I'm just trying to get at the what he's saying about how to proceed. He says, the most absurd Okay, I'll skip that one too. Colin claims that he's working class. He's a working class man, so therefore he can't be called a clever intellectual. He's not just, he doesn't live a life of intellectualism because he says he's working class. But he says that can't be said for Taylor, Spencer, and Johnson, but they make up for it by being American. How does that work? Huh? And then he says he grew up in a majority black society, partly grew up in a majority black society, so he knows how that works too. What does he mean by that? I don't know. He doesn't, yuck, anyway, grow up in a majority black society. Now, let's see, going on. He says, intellectualism should not be underestimated. By exploring new ideas and developing new critiques of the modern leftist, globalized, feminized, egalitarian world, we develop new intellectual weapons and useful insights that can then be reformulated in increasingly populist and basic language to create the memes, axioms, taglines, and factoids to red pill a large number of people whose interests they ultimately serve. Well, that's pretty intellectualized right there. He's going and telling us how these things are going to be done, and yet, I don't know, are they working? Well, maybe. Things like white countries, the white countries are for everybody, but other countries are for their own people, or anti-racist is another word for anti-white, things like that. How well do they work? I don't know, because I'm not one of those people who needs to have my mind changed. So, but this is what he thinks, this is what he's saying is the way to go. And yet this was all done a long time ago by the National Socialists in Germany. They developed all these things, and they used all these things. They had all kinds of sayings and what we now call memes, and they had axioms and facts and so on. They did all that. But now he wants to ignore all that they did, which is still available to us. And if we had kept, I'm saying if we had kept going with what we had there after 1945, in some way, better than we have done, we wouldn't have to be starting again now when it's too late. I mean, to me, these people, someone like this guy, Colin Liddell, thinks that I see that, you know, he wants to have his words in his name. He wants to be the leader of a movement. And all these fellows want to be the leader of something new that they think is new, which isn't new, but they don't want to use what came before except amongst certain of the writers that they like, which are the most, inoffensive and intellectualized type writers that they like to bring forward. And the people who really accomplish something beyond, and certainly in any kind of modern times, beyond anything anyone else ever did, they want to ignore and crush under their feet, step on as though they're horrible. This I don't get. Now he says, going down a ways, yes, based on empirical evidence, a rational case can be made for undue Jewish influence and examples of malevolence towards white ethnic interests, but who are you going to convince when you go into storm fag mode? He's saying a rational case can be made for undue Jewish influence and examples of malevolence towards white ethnic interests. But you can't make that case if you go into storm fag mode. Well, he's talking about Daily Stormer. I don't know what storm fag exactly means, except it was supposed to refer to stormfront, I guess. Stormfront mode, only they call stormfront stormfag. That's it. All right. I think it's a bunch of fags or something. Well, that's what stormfront people think about these guys. But there again, you have a big division between the different branches, the different types of people. And these, he says, I say that I agree that we need to make a better case for it. I agree that we need to make a very good case for Jewish malevolence and harm towards the white, towards white interests in the white race. We need to make that case. We're not making that case as well as we could, but the problem is he doesn't like the way the storm fags do it, but he's not doing it at all. And this group of people are doing it, but in a way that would take, are they reaching people? I mean, how long will it take for them to reach the people when it's already just probably too late to do anything about it anyway? When I see people who are saying this, and I'm saying this, when I see people who are saying this and I see this kind of case they're making, I see that they're no one to talk because they're not accomplishing it. You know, they're criticizing how some people go about it, but they're not accomplishing anything themselves. If they say, well, we're just getting started, well, boy, it's pretty late to just get started. And that's, again, why I don't see why we can't use what we've already, what we already have. He says, because of anti-Zionism's proximity in the popular mind to Hitlerian anti-Semitism, any moves to talk about excessive or inimical Jewish influence have to be handled carefully and agreed on moral standards and concepts of justice. I'm just grabbing a few words out of there. Let me explain this. See, he calls it Hitlerian anti-Semitism. I guess if you come straight out and say, we don't want, Jews have to go, Jews are our misfortune, they took, you know, the National Socialists took their time to get the Jews out of their country. They had a lot of programs first that were slow, and they got, you know, they got a number of them going here, going there. But, you know, with all that they had to do, and then when after the war, and they were occupying all these countries with all these Jews, and they had all these Jews to move, they realized they had to do something much stronger than what they'd been doing. And they still had various programs, but it was only then, after none of those worked out, that they did the deportation on a mass scale. But this is to talk about the harm that Jews do, like they did then, the Jews were doing to Germany, he calls it Hitlerian anti-Semitism and thinks it's excessive. And you have to handle that very carefully. And you have to remember that there are agreed on moral standards and concepts of justice. So, you know, there he's bringing up that we have to be just to everyone. We have to treat them in a moral way. And when you do that with Jews, you'll never get rid of them. You'll never get anywhere with them. And also, these moral standards and concepts of justice are mostly based on lies. I mean, you know, we're gonna be accepting all their lies for why you can't do this to them and you can't do that to them. And so, they won't get anywhere with this. There's no movement forward possible in this, but that's the best that he can accept. That's the way he wants to do it. I think he's dreaming. And then he talks about the convinced Jew hater, and as there's such a person, which is not a good person, because he thinks that the convinced Jew hater is the one who wants all this hateful stuff. Of course, he calls it a Jew hater. See, to hate Jews is wrong. He doesn't. And you're not supposed to show that you do. You can't show any kind of hate. Well, they show hate, but you can't show hate back. It's pretty interesting. He thinks that's going to get him somewhere. All right. See what else is important here. Um, Now, here he says, but growling men of action, I mean, real strong men, which I guess he considers himself one, the rough-cut heroes of the hour, etc., can only arise if they are preceded by genuine popular mass movements. All right? And he says, well, even Hitler knew that. He tried it both ways. First time, you know, with the putsch, and it didn't work. Then he then decided to follow the democracy, and he took him 10 years or so, but he eventually won over the state. Now, he's right about that. But Hitler did do it democratically. Hitler was a democratically elected or appointed leader. And he had the support of the people the whole time. Everybody knows that. I mean, you can, if you don't know it, you can be taught that very. You know, Hitler always had the support of the people. And yet he's trying to portray Hitler as this monstrous person and who didn't have a popular mass movement. Well, he's not, but he's saying that and nobody today can get anywhere without this a genuine popular base to start out with. Well, I wonder how these men whose names have been brought up here today, how they are going to get this mass movement. But I'm not saying that that Andrew Anglin is either. I don't believe anybody's doing it right. So there again, you go. You know, I think it should be done some different way. I wish I was a lot younger and I would start out doing that. But this is it's probably some kind of a combination of the two approaches. You know, where you have to come out with things very boldly, but you also have to have very good arguments, and you have to have a way to convince people and you have to have a way to educate people, because they're not educated on it. And then you have to not be closed down by the governments. So says the he's just uncomfortable with anything to do with swastikas and jackboots, he says. And he thinks we should look to the successful models abroad. And here, to succeed, white nationalism in America will have to look to successful models abroad. With this, he brings up France's Front National, which, you know, just one is leading in France, Holland's Freedom Party, 13%, UKIP, 27%, True Finns, 12.9%, Sweden Democrats, 13%. And he thinks this is just amazing what these parties have accomplished, and that this can go, this is the way to go. And he admits that these parties could be greatly improved, but at least the possibilities are healthier than with, again, he goes on to the Nazi porn. He calls it mentally masturbating to Nazi porn. But, you know, it remains to be seen what these parties are going to do. And what they're going to be, as I already mentioned earlier, if they do succeed, what they're going to look like. You know, some of them are not going to, but a couple of them might. And what will they look like? By the time they're able to win a general election and get some real power, they're not going to look like anything that Hitler's party looked like and what way Hitler was able to function. In Germany, he made sure that he didn't give everything away and he didn't concede anything to anyone else. That's what they were trying to get him to do, but he was too smart for that. And when he did get in, he was able to get total power. So I don't think these parties are anywhere close to the quality of what he had. So I think we need to point out how good all that was, and this is what we should be trying to achieve. And we can use. I don't think we should get carried away with symbols and flags and so on and stuff like Daily Stormer does. I disagree myself with what they do. I think the owner there is using National Socialism instead of being a National Socialist. I think he's using it in order to get attention to the site and in order to look tough and strong and so on, without any intention of doing anything about any of it. Well, you know, without any plan or any program. I don't see it as really honest, and I don't see it as helpful either. And that might come up another time. I was going to read some more stuff about some comments from there, but I think I've covered enough of that. I'm going to go on, and I might go over a little bit, ladies and gentlemen. I want to invite people to call if they want to comment on what I've talked about, or if they want to say anything. We've still got 8 minutes, and I can also go over the 2 hours. So the phone number is 323-642-1206. 323-642-1206. All right, I got some material. I have a little comment here from Majority Rights, because that's another site that has become very anti-Hitler, anti-Germany, anti-National Socialism. Oh, that's bad news, bad news. It's always been that way to a degree, although they had a lot of pro-Hitler people, I believe, writing on there and commenting and so on. But the owner of the site, Guest Worker, was wary of that, didn't really go along with that. I wasn't that much of a reader of Majority Rights all that time, so I can't say exactly how it was, but that's the impression I have. And he has been turning that site over to this fellow, Daniel Sinuski. I didn't get his last name right, but it's Polish. And I've talked about him in the past. I've did a show talking about him, so I don't need to repeat all that. You can go back. You can go and look it up if you want to find out. But he's always going on about this now. He's taking over the site from Guest Worker, and I suppose Guest Worker is allowing that because Daniel is the only one who comes out real strongly for what he considers white nationalism and any kind of a country nationalism, but very much against Hitler's National Socialism in that Third Reich in Germany. So because it was, again, because he's Polish and he's got that Polish, he thinks he's totally objective, but it's because he's Polish and he wants to defend Poland and any other country that would have happened to them and his, as he sees it, as happened to Poland. At the hands of the National Socialists, at the hands of Hitler. So he wrote something. And I want to quote a few of it. He again talks about the moral high ground, and he sees Adolf Hitler as not having any moral high ground whatsoever, and that we need the moral high ground. So he's to succeed, but we know that moral high ground has always been pretty hypocritical, and those with the moral high who are really carrying out a moral high ground are hardly ever the winners. So that doesn't really follow, but that's what that's what he pushes. And so he wrote here that he was writing to Jimmy Marr, who made some comment, some hateful. Some comment about exterminating Jews, and so he's correcting him, saying that that's not tactful, and it's why we need the moral high ground. And he says a lot of Jews died in World War II, and whether it is called a Holocaust or Shoah is not necessarily important. We know they are preoccupied with theirs and not with ours, and the subsequent generations. Of whites have been unjustly punished for these deaths. See, he's acknowledging right off the bat, which he always does. And a lot of these kind of people always do. This is the same thing Greg Johnson did when he wrote back a couple years ago on Occidental Observer, that very well-read article about why we don't need to deal with the Holocaust and white nationalism, why we don't, and that's still kind of pertinent, you know. All these people have the same idea. We don't want to deal with National Socialism. We want to forget it, walk away from it, and we don't want to deal with the Holocaust. We don't want to talk about it, and they don't. So this is what Daniel here is saying, too. He's saying, we don't want to do that, even though they were wrong and they did a lot of wrong things, you know, the Jews. We have to keep, you know, still he's admitting, he wants us to believe that a lot of terrible things happen to them, that they have that moral high ground because of it. And he's saying that there is a reason for separation from Jews in total, which is what Hitler and only Hitler did, but still he's afraid of it. See, these people are too cowardly to do anything like that. He says, but the piles of skeletal bodies we have all seen are not a hoax. See, he makes that statement straight out, believing in the Holocaust. And I write, and you know, my comment there is, oh, yes, they are, because they are attributed to causes other than what was responsible for them. You know, all those piles of skeletal bodies are labeled in a way that makes them a hoax. It's basically a hoax because they were not killed for in the way that it said that they were killed. So in a whole lot of them, the responsible party is the Allies. So, but none of this is ever said. You see, this is the part that, this is where the education comes in and the things that need to be said to explain what really took place. But instead, these men who want to be our leaders and run these sites that they want people to come to are admitting the guilt, but it's okay with them because it's the guilt of the Germans. See, he's not German. And he's on top of it, he's Polish and doesn't like the Germans. And he says his father was Italian. So he says he's Polish and Italian. I don't know why he has a Polish last name if his father was Italian and his mother Polish. But in any event, not something I'll lose sleep over. He says none of us in the subsequent generations should be penalized. That's exactly the same position that Greg Johnson took. That this happened before us. We didn't do it. We should just forget about it. They can't try to blame it on us. Tell them to go jump, you know, and find somebody else because I'm not guilty of any of that. Well, but that leaves the Germans and that leaves the Third Reich and that leaves Hitler's National Socialism responsible for it. And that's what they don't care about. They don't care about because they're not German. A lot of good people who aren't German do care about it. But I mean, you know, it's like it's what's called a blood libel or a false libel against the German people. And therefore, if these people are really white nationalists and think that that what happens to one happens to all, that we're all together in this, then they would care about it. So there again, I don't know what kind of white nationalists they are. On the other hand, I think that, I'm going to be going off the air to those who are listening to me, and I'm going to have to finish this off. Somebody's here. No, that's his. Okay. Hi there, caller. Somehow I've got a caller. Hi, caller.
Well, hello. Is this Carolyn?
Yes, it is. Hi, Bob. Okay. I hear you. I can recognize you.
Hi there. Yeah, I'm just calling to listen in because to continue listening, you have to call in.
Oh, I see.
You know, it cuts
off.
Right. But if you call in, because I would like to make a comment, but I missed the first section. But as soon as I turned it on, my ears burned because my name was being mentioned. But I didn't hear the whole thing. So I want to go back and listen to the whole thing. I will have some comments, though, after I listen to the whole thing. I may mention it on the show tomorrow, or I may do it in an email, or not an email, but a comment to the show. But I would rather re-listen to the whole thing first, though.
Okay, all righty. Well, I'll just try to pick up here and see what I want to say still before I call it into the program. I was talking about what Daniel from Daniel S. from Majority Rights was writing in this comment. And a lot of what he writes is in the form of comments over at Majority Rights. The comments are as important as the posts that are put up there, actually. So he says, I am not at all convinced. Then he goes after the revisionists, see. This is where, again, I think he was reading Greg Johnson, and I think he's reading Mark Weber, and I don't think he gets much he gets his ideas from other people. And this is just word for just exactly what Johnson and Weber were saying a couple of years ago in saying that we can do without Holocaust revisionism. We can just kind of leave that. It's not helping out anything. Let's move on. Let's move on and step. Greg used the terms, let's step over that. And I think all these other white nationalist intellectual ones that I've mentioned are not are agreeable to that. Of course, not Bob, who just called in. I did mention Tom Metzger and Bob, but I mentioned them in kind of a different context, I think. I don't see them as part of this group, intellectual group. But they see themselves as intellectuals. Anyway, so then Daniel goes on to say, I am not at all convinced that the revisionists are truth seekers or that their whole angle of revisionism is very useful at this point. Does that sound familiar? Then he says, the point is that the people of this generation are innocent of any doings of Nazi Germany if they want to be. So there again, we just say, you know, we weren't there. We didn't do it. So don't blame me. Blame the Nazis. That I see as cowardly, and someone who's afraid to argue with Jews doesn't want to carry out this argument because revisionism or Holocaust is a very difficult field to deal in, and they don't want to do that. They're not interested in it really. So then he says though that he again attacks revisionists. Maybe he's reading David Cole. And he says, revisionists rather come across as propagandists, just a little bit biased and telegraphing sadistic ways and means that not everyone wants to be associated with. I don't think he even reads revisionists. That's an ignorant statement. And for him to say that about revisionists as coming across as propagandists who are biased is pretty far-fetched because most of them go out of their way not to be. And I'm all for being a little bit more biased and propagandistic when it comes to dealing with the Holocaust, but with revising it. But most of the well-known ones are not. So this is the attitude. You see, this is this anti attitude by so many who are accepted in as white nationalists, and he calls himself a white nationalist. He's that's the way he describes himself, this Daniel. He finishes up by saying, add to this the list of tricks. And now these are the list of tricks that are played by, I guess, revisionists and whoever else he said was not a truth seeker. He says, reject Hitler and you are a Jew. Reject revisionism and you are a Jew. Hitler was a total good. That's also a trick. All negative things attributed to Nazi Germany are a total fraud. That's bullshit, he says. He ends up with bullshit. That's his comment. So there you go. I didn't get to play my break music. Once again, I get up to that first hour so fast, I don't want to stop. I've got some nice new break music, and I'm not playing it. I keep thinking I'll do it next time. Well, ladies and gentlemen, maybe I'll go out with my regular music, I guess. I better. So that's it for tonight, and there's probably a lot of summing up and really what needs to be said following what arguments need to be made with more carefulness and more exactitude than what I've presented here today. And I don't know that I'm going to be doing that, but I hope that if this does start a debate and Bob says he's going to have some comments about it, I'd be very glad about that. We'll see what comes from it. So thank you very much for listening to Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn today. And this has been the October 4th edition, and I will do expect to see you on Monday. Maybe I'll have to be carrying on about this again. I don't know, but I'll see you on Monday evening with the Heretics Hour. Goodbye.